seven sisters in one house. They were not sisters because of genealogy or familial connection, but they were for a moment united in a common goal. And that gave me pause to consider, what is it like to be part of a team? I mean, where individual aspirations are subjugated to the purpose and the plan of the whole. Seven sisters. They've been called, for want of a better description, the Magnificent Seven. And I speak of the United States gymnastic team, whose members pulled off, for the first time in history, Olympic history, winning of the team gold medal. You see, these are seven individuals who normally compete against one another in all kinds of configurations and on various apparati, I guess is the appropriate term, not apparatuses, apparati. And they compete against one another, but for a moment in time, they united in a common goal and a common purpose. J.C. Phelps and Shannon Miller and Amanda Borden and Dominique Dawes and that other little diminutive Dominique called Moshianu is the way it's pronounced. And, of course, Carrie Strug. If you're not a sports fan, that's okay, but you can't have missed it. They've talked about it this week because of what Carrie Strug did. Interesting, the conversation that was recorded because her coach was being microphoned, and so we could get involved in the conversation. When she took her first fall, and that followed, of course, Dominique Moshianu's fall twice on her derriere, which caused all to wonder if America would let the gold medal slip away. But Carrie Strug came up to her time on the vault, and she fell, too, on her derriere. But she also injured her ankle. The conversation went like this. Carrie said, how close are we to her coach, Bella Caroli? And he said, very close. You can do it. Very close. You can do it. We don't expect a lot from teenagers, do we? But this team consisted all of teenagers, the youngest being 14. I don't know how you are about having a microphone or a camera put in your face, but it's not a comfortable thing. And yet they responded with appropriate comments, with a certain amount of aplomb and a certain amount of experience and expertise, not befitting, belying the fact that they were teenagers. And yet they captured the imagination of us all, a team effort. And I guess we could say of Carrie Strug, she took one for the team. She took one for the team. And it got me reflecting back on my memories of sports and team sports in particular, because if a person is an individual, that's one thing. But to be part of a team is another. And I got to thinking back to my high school days and football and so forth, and the year our team was devastated or decimated, however you want to term it, by ineligibility. You know, you have to have eligible grades and so forth. So we fielded a football team for the last game of the year with 15 players. Our quarterback broke his leg in the first quarter. And yet he played the entire game on it. High school. Because we had nobody else to play quarterback. Now, at the time, like Carrie, he didn't know it was broken. It just hurt. And so he, in his mind and pain and delirium, if you will, decided he would take one for the team because the team needed him. I can't help but remember a basketball player, since that was one of the games I loved a lot, Willis Reed. If you are a basketball fan, you have to remember Willis Reed limping out on the court in the final game of a championship series. Unfortunately, it was against our Los Angeles Lakers. We lived in Pasadena and we were following the Lakers, but the New York Knicks captain with an injured leg came out and played for a few moments, gave an uplift to his team, and they vanquished the Los Angeles Lakers because Willis Reed took one for the team. In 1972, most people forget this, but the Lakers got their revenge against those same New York Knicks and won that championship with Wilt Chamberlain at the center with two broken bones in both hands in that final game he played and was victorious because he took one for the team. And then all around 1988, Isaiah Thomas was playing for the Detroit Pistons. That's where I lived at the time, and so I guess you might say I was a Piston fan, but he sprained his ankle severely. And against, again, the Los Angeles Lakers, he put on one of the most amazing displays of scoring and uplifting his team that you could ever imagine on a very badly sprained ankle because the team needed him. To take sometimes has a negative connotation. It means to grab or to abrogate or to apprehend or to hold on to or to steal or something like that. But really, it can be a selfish term, it also can express the supreme sacrifice, because take can mean endure. Take it on the chin, we say. Take it on the chin. And there's a aphorism or statement that's made about all for one and one for all. And when we look at sometimes in sports the ideals of team effort and sportsmanship and those kinds of things come out before us, and we see it. The Apostle Paul was not unfamiliar with this notion. Being familiar with the Greek world and the Roman world and all of the acrobatics and the sportsmanship and all of the competition that went on, he decided to write to the Corinthian church that was having a problem in taking one for the team. It was a church that was divided, that was having great difficulty recognizing what its mission was and how it was going to be successful in a team effort. Because one of the things I've learned and observed over time is that you cannot win a team sport without team effort. It doesn't work. You've heard the old saying, there is no I in team. And there is not. Because you have to subjugate oneself, one's will, one's personal attributes, and all of that to the common goal of the whole. Natural instinct, on the other hand, is for self-preservation. You know, for self-aggrandizement. So in the ninth chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul decides to not only to discuss the issue from an athletic perspective, but he also examines himself, or at least uses himself as an example of what it means to take one for the team. Oh, in other places he talked about it to tell the Corinthian church that, yeah, I've taken a lot for the team. I've taken lots of stripes, 40 minus one on several occasions. I've been stoned. I've been imprisoned. I've been through a lot of things. He later wrote the Roman church, but none of that would separate me from the love of God, because in taking one for the team, I know that my future is secure. So in 1 Corinthians, the ninth chapter, verse 19, he says this, "For though I am free," that's like saying, though I am liberated, though I have my own talents and abilities, though I am an individual, I'm free from all men, I have made myself a slave or servant to all, that I may win the more. You know, when you think about what happened with the Olympics and the gymnastic gold team gold medal, you contrast the victory of the gold medal with the fact that those three individuals who went on to compete for the individual honors failed as individuals. But collectively, as a team, they were successful. And so they can, with pride and dignity, remember that moment. Paul here acknowledges that as an individual, you have freedoms and rights and things to do like you see fit. But as part of a team, it is not so. To the Jews, he says, you know, when I was playing on the team with the Jews, I became like a Jew. And when I found myself in a situation to deal with those who were under the law, which were like the Jews, then I was under the law, though not being myself under the law that I might win those who were under the law. Verse 21, to those who are without the law, the Gentiles, in other words, that's how I became to them, though not being without the law of God at all, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those who are without law. Paul recognized the importance of working as a team. He, earlier in this book, commented on that fact that while I may have planted something and Apollos may have watered it, in this team effort, God is the one who brings the increase. It's a significant statement and recognition of what it's like to be part of the team and how sometimes one has to take one for the team. Here's what he says in verse 22. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. And I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker, a partner, a team player of it. And then he draws upon the analogy and his understanding of sports. He says, now do you not know that those who run in a race all run? And we're all in a race, aren't we? We're all in this effort as a part of the team. But only one receives the prize. Now we can break that down to individuality of one receiving the prize, but in a relay situation, it's a team effort. If one on the team drops the baton, all are disqualified. And if one or two foul up in the gymnastics team goal effort, they all are disqualified. But if one is successful and achieves a high mark, they all win. He goes on to say, run in such a way that you may win. Now, as individuals responsible to God by ourselves, we can run individually, but when we are working as part of a team, we must run so that the team wins. The team. And everyone, in verse 25, who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable crown or a wreath, but we, an imperishable one. It's interesting that he would draw this analogy because in the old days of the Roman games and the Greek games, when one was victorious, a slave would stand over you, by you with a wreath over your head and would whisper in your ear, all glory is fleeting. All glory is fleeting. Just to remind you, and if you were part of the military and come back from a successful campaign, that same statement would be whispered in your ear in the Roman and the Greek world. All glory is fleeting. But Paul here makes an analogy that these people work real hard for an imperishable crown. He says, but therefore I run in such a way as not without aim. I box in such a way as not beating the air, shadow boxing, in other words. But I buffet my body and make it my slave, lest possibly after I have preached to others, I myself should be disqualified. Now, he seems to be speaking of an individual notion, but Paul recognized he was part of a team. That he had a mission. That he had to preach the gospel. He had to carry it. And there were those who worked with him. There were those who were working in other venues, if you will. But they were all part of the team process. One for all and all for one. We should all run, in other words, perform our task as part of the team. That's why when you go to 1 Corinthians 12, and many of us have been through that section many times, but he goes on to use the analogy again by saying, okay, if you are part of a team or the body, that's where he uses that analogy, you know, and he does it in Romans 12 as well, but right here he talks about there are parts of the body that have different requirements, things that it must perform. And when that part of the body performs well, it accrues to the benefit of the entire body. Because no parts of the body starts ostracizing the other, or saying, I can get along very well without this hand. After all, I am right-handed. I don't really need the left one. Nobody says that for some reason. You kind of like to have them both because there are times when you need them both. The eyes, I could use just one eye, but it sure is nice having depth perception. You know, it's nice to have two eyes, or four as the case might be. It's nice to have that. It's nice to be able to count on your disparate parts, your individual parts, and have them work in harmony, because it's important for the team and its success. He says at one point that some parts of the body have honor and glory, and others are not so onerous. But they all fit together and they work together. And in this team effort, when one is successful, everybody is successful. If one is joyous, everybody shares in the joy. It's a collective. It's an effort as part of the team, all for one and one for all. Now, whether the team is called a family, or whether the team is called a tribe, or a clan, or a kit and kin, or a church assembly, doesn't matter what you call it. It's supposed to be part of a team. Part of a team. And as part of the team, Paul urged them that each part should do its bit. Over in Hebrews, the 12th chapter, this is after Paul, who I feel wrote the book. Great controversy is who's the author, but so much evidence seems to indicate to me that Paul did. After chapter 11, he lists the names of a lot of people, a lot of individuals who are significant in the annals of faith. And then in chapter 12 and verse 1, he makes this astounding statement that, therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance. You see, when you were training for the Olympics in the old days in the Greek world, in the Roman world, you would weight yourself down as you practiced to run a race, so that when it was time to run the race, you discarded the weights so you could run faster, could be more productive. When I played basketball, we used to have these ankle weights so you could jump higher, you know, be quicker afoot and all that. And so it was nice to practice in those, to walk to the store in those, and to do all the things you could do so when you took them off, you could just be leaps and bounds over everybody else. Paul recognized that particular quality and says, now laying aside every weight or encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, let us run. Let us perform our task with endurance, the race that is set before us. But let's not forget the context of him saying this. He's just listed a great group of people. He called them a cloud of witnesses, from Abel all the way to the unnamed masses who were sawn asunder, who stopped the mouths of lions, etc., etc. He lists all of those people as clouds of witnesses because, you know what? They were part of a team. And when you go back and look at some of them, you realize they took one for the team. Abel certainly took one for the team. You see, he did what was right, and it cost him his life. That's taking one for the team. His brother of the flesh rocked him to sleep because he didn't like what he was doing. But it did not change Abel's focus from doing what was necessary. He took one for the team. Abraham. Oh, he took a lot of lumps for the team. He took a lot of ridicule, I'm sure. Family members saying, what in the world? You're packing up to go where? You don't know where you're going? You leaving your family behind? Isn't family important to you? But you see, Abraham was being called to a new team. The book of Hebrews describes it this way, as going to a city whose maker was God. And that city was not made by hand. And he had to take a journey to Mount Moriah of 3 days in order to take one for the team, to sacrifice his son Isaac. Oh, he took a lot for the team. So when we talk of this cloud of witnesses that Paul identifies here for us, it's with an idea that in this assembly, in this group, in this aggregation of people, it's required upon us, just like for those clouds of witnesses, a cloud of witnesses, should take one from time to time. Christ put together a team. He put together a team of 12 co-captains and about 120 members of the team, or so, teammates we'll call them. That's the figure we get out of Acts, the first chapter, 120 who gathered together in the upper room to discuss who would replace Judas. So about 120 folk, after Christ's ministry had been completed, they were part of the team. And he wanted them to comprehend how important it was for them to take one for the team. He told them many things, but among them was to love one another. John 15, if we will. But don't put it out of the context of what he's saying and why he's saying what he's saying. To this carnal group of people, to this divergent group of folk, from fishermen to tax collectors to religious zealots, nationalistic heroes, all varying in their view of things and all with different apparitions, probably united by the one notion that maybe the kingdom would be restored to Israel. That was the last thing they asked Christ before he ascended into the clouds. Is it at this time that you will restore the kingdom to Israel? So with this different group of people, he told them many things, but on this occasion, in chapter 15 and verse 13, he says, "Now, greater love has no one than this, than one lay down his life for his friend." Take one for the team. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you slaves or servants, but for the slave does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things that I have learned or heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you. Those of you in the past, in your life long ago, did you ever stand around in a group of young people, children, and they start choosing sides? Who's going to be on what team? You ever been through that experience, and it gets down towards the end, and it doesn't look like you're going to get chosen? You ever had that feeling? What that's like? You're the runt of the litter. You don't have the athletic ability. You're not old enough. You don't have the experience and the expertise, and so begrudgingly, somewhere along the line, we'll come on over here. We'll take you. How that make you feel? Makes you feel. Christ here says, I've chosen you as part of my team, as part of my group, and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit. Isn't it interesting that he's saying this to a group of people who's supposed to be part of a team? And he says it in the context of them not being so harmonious either. That your fruit should remain, that whatever you ask of my Father in my name, he may give it to you. This I command you, that you love one another. The context of him saying that cannot be missed, because earlier in chapter 13, he says a couple of things about this love thing, this love feast. In verse 34, he says, "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you." I mean, a qualifying clause. And all they had to do was analyze, how has Christ loved us? And they hadn't quite gotten the full impact of it yet, but they would, because Christ was going to give them the excellence of what it means to take one for the team. But right now he just tells them, by this, all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. And he says this to them when they didn't have love for another, one for another. They didn't. They didn't have it at all. The fact is that sometimes you have to take some grief and pain when you love. Jesus Christ says these things to them in the midst of individualistic maneuvering by some of the 12. They were not yet team players. Look at Luke 22 in this passage to comprehend. When I look at the faces of what they call the Magnificent Sevens, their youth, their vision and their focus, and the up and down ride of their quest towards the unreachable stars. Sometimes, you know, one would have a bobble, but they all would congratulate each other. They would all encourage one another. They all come and band together. If one had a bad situation or a low score, they would kind of encourage him, be there to support him, because it was for the team. But here's how the disciples functioned. Chapter 22, verse 24. He says, and there arose also a dispute among them as to which one of them was regarded to be the greatest. Wow. Wow. I mean, at the most sensitive time, the most emotional time of Christ's ministry and his time with them, this is what they were arguing about. This is what they were fussing about. This is how the team was functioning, which was not a team at this point in time. Look at Mark's account. Mark 9, this is a different time. Mark 9 and verse 34. Mark was very terse in his record keeping here. Verse 34 he says, and they kept silent, for on the way they had discussed with one another which of them was the greatest. Muhammad Ali had not come along then to dispute with them about who was the greatest. And so they didn't have a frame of reference. But they argued among themselves about that. Now, that will destroy a team. Oh, sure it will. There are many pro sports teams that come along with lots of talent, significantly more talent than other teams, but they wind up being defeated because they don't understand the concept that there is no I in team. I could go back and recite for you all the NBA champions from 1957 forward. That's when I started watching basketball. It's pretty easy to do it from 1958 to 1966. You just say Boston times eight. The Boston Celtics won eight consecutive championships, and how did they do that? Were they more talented than other teams? No, not necessarily. But they understood that you have to sacrifice. You have to play a part. If you can't score like the other player, I can play defense, or I can get the rebound, or I can do some other thing to be successful. And they understood that. So in the sports world, hope you know one takes offense at me using a sports analogy in this way, because Paul did it, didn't he? Several times, because he knew that you could extract from the athletic endeavor, this kind of principle of teamwork. So here they are squabbling and fussing. In chapter 10, verse 35, Christ spends a little time discussing it with them. And they're named here now, James and John, specifically the two sons of Zebedee, came up to him saying to him, oh, great teacher, oh, master, oh, person who can make my day, who can give me what I desire, some recognition, some attention, and some position. Teacher, we want you to do for us whatsoever we ask of you. What do you want me to do? Grant that we may sit in your glory. Everybody wants glory. Everybody wants it. From the time you enter into this veil of tears until it's time to exit, glory is something all human beings desire. And it's interesting that Christ does not put them down for wanting glory. He says you can have some glory, but you got to go through something to get it. Because the glory that you want is not like the glory whispered into the ear by the slave to the Roman. All glory is fleeting. No, the glory that you can obtain is not fleeting. It's for all eternity. So Christ here does not put them down because they want some glory. Oh, it's nice they want glory, but how do you obtain it? He says to them, you do not know what you're asking of me, in verse 38. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink, or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? And of course, their instantaneous answer is like saying, can you play ball? Can you run track? Can you be a gymnast? Oh, sure I can. But are you willing to go through what is necessary to obtain it? Are you willing to take that second jump? Not really knowing if it's necessary, but your coach tells you, we're close. You can do it. You can do it. Yeah, we're able. And Jesus said to them, the cup that I drink, you shall drink. And you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized. But to sit on my right and on my left, this is not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it has been prepared. The Father knows who will receive such an honor. But that honor is not obtained because, well, you're buddies. And hearing this, the ten began to feel indignant towards James and John. They were upset. It fractured the team. It caused division among the team because somebody is trying to have one-upsmanship on another. And calling them to himself, the captain of our salvation, the captain of the team, said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the nations lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them. But it is not so among you. For whosoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, the one who takes one for the team. You see, it was in John 13 that he illustrated what he was talking about by washing their feet. This captain, this master, this Lord, took one for the team. And he described to the disciples the kind of road they should go. And whoever wishes to be first among you shall be a slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Wow. Christ, the greatest gift of all, was a servant. He was a team player. Didn't he often say, I and the Father are one? I only speak what the Father has told me to speak. I only do what the Father wants me to do. He was a team player. He was one who recognized that he gave himself for the team, for it was the Father's will. In Philippians, the second chapter, one of the most moving pieces of Paul's writing, where he writes to a church that had learned a lot about teamwork. You see, Paul had needs from time to time, and at this point in time, Paul is a prisoner in Rome. He has certain financial needs and probably some needs of being encouraged, being cut off from those people and churches that he had raised up, and there were some who responded to his needs, but the Philippian church went over and above. Well, they were part of the team, and he's writing to compliment them on that fact. It was a church he dearly loved. But he didn't want them to be satisfied that they had done everything already. that they had attained. He writes that in the third chapter. He says, I don't count myself to have apprehended, but this one thing I do, I put those things from the past behind and press on towards the mark of the prize of the high calling in Christ Jesus. He told them that, but in the second chapter he throws in this poignant vignette of the consummate team player. If therefore there is any encouragement in Christ, if there is any consolation, if there is any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and compassion, look at those words, how descriptive they are of the way Christ is and how all of us should be. He says to them, make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. How many saw that kind of spirit, if you were able to see even just the replays regarding the Olympic moment I'm talking about? Anybody not see any of that? Raise your hand if you didn't get a chance to. Well, hopefully they were playing enough so you get a taste of it. And try to relate it to what it is that you're involved in from a spiritual perspective. I was moved by it. I was captivated by it. These young people. And we could go through the history of mankind and American history and Canadian history about people who have sacrificed, who've given the full measure of devotion as Abraham Lincoln described it on the plains of Gettysburg. We talk about the kamikaze, the divine wind of the sacrifice of flying a plane into, yes, the Allied forces. And we don't like that very much, but we had some fellows who did similar stuff. Maybe didn't fly a plane into a Japanese place, but they flew bombs over Tokyo, didn't they? Some of them didn't come back. Lots of them didn't come back from Europe because they were part of a team. And they knew that they had to fly in formation. They knew that they had to fulfill their task. And if they were on the ground facing the enemy, whether it was in tanks or on the grunts on the ground, they all knew they had a part to play and they had to fulfill it. Now, that's in warfare. That's in a temporal goal. Just as in athleticism, it's temporary. All glory is fleeting. But here, Paul ties in this principle that we extract from the great sacrificer, Jesus Christ. Do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, in verse 3. Do nothing. But with humility of mind, let each of you regard one another as more important than himself. That's how teams win. That's how they are successful. That's how they get to where they want to go, through a united effort, an effort that is cohesive and international, if you will. Do not merely look out for your own personal interests, but also for the interests of others. Do you realize that in the team competition in gymnastics, only the top three from the victorious team gets to go on to compete as individuals? You see, that's how that works. So, despite that fact that in seven members of the team working together for this common goal of the gold medal, only three can go on to the individual marks and the individual success. Paul writes the Corinthians, the Philippians in this regard, and says, all right, have this attitude in yourselves, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself. I'd say he was taking one for the team. Taking the form of a bondservant and being made in the likeness of men and being found in appearance as man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even the death of the stake or the cross or the torture tree. That's taking one for the team. The spiritual that I refer to from time to time that I've sung for you, where this imaginary conversation goes on, where Jesus Christ goes to the Father and says, prepare me one body like man, and I'll go down and die. That's taking one for the team. That's sacrificing one for the team. And as a result of his sacrifice, as a result of him giving his full measure of devotion, verse 9 through 11 declares that Christ has now obtained more glory. And it's not fleeting. It's not a temporal glory. Therefore also God highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, of those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. So we want glory. That's okay. The disciples wanted it. And Christ says, you can have it. Just be prepared to drink of my cup and to go through the things that I go through, because that's how you're going to obtain it. This team, I call it some have called it the Teen Dream Team. The oldest was 19. Two of them were 19, you know. The Teen Dream Team worked hard with ups and downs, with final victory for a perishable crown, a medal. It's actually a silver medal with gold overlaying it. That's what it is. Now, that's a medal to be treasured, and it's a goal to be achieved, but sometimes in life you find that it's not quite as important as other things. In 1960, when a young Cassius Marcellus Clay came back from Rome, having won a gold medal in boxing, light heavyweight division, he went back to Louisville, Kentucky, the place of his birth, the place where he grew up, the place that he knew well. And it was a segregated South, to be sure. But nobody whispered in Ali's ear or Cassius Clay's ear that all glory is fleeting, because he expected that as a result of triumphing and standing on the winner's stand and having the national anthem played and the flag raised, that he was now accepted in the American mainstream. And to his disappointment, it was the same Louisville that he left. He was so distressed, he went out on a bridge in Louisville over a river and threw his gold medal into it, where it rests at the bottom, all currents carried it wherever, never to be seen again. It was a perishable item. Others have given a claim and recognition and a place of honor for their awards, their gold medals. Some have even hawked theirs. But the point is, after all of that time, Muhammad Ali, who had changed his name over the years, and we all know of his story and his bout with his disease, that it's hard to imagine this brash young man from Louisville, the Louisville Lip, they used to call it, isn't it? And it's hard to imagine that he could float like a butterfly and sting like a bee and have all of those rhyming statements that he made concerning his opponents and how he would vanquish them in so many rounds and all of that, and to proclaim he was the greatest. He was asked by a friend, would you like, if you could, have that medal again? And he said, yes, I would like to have it, in his broken speech. So a man who worked hard and laboriously to get the Olympic Committee, headquartered, I think, in Europe someplace, to see if they would not recast that medal and allow Muhammad Ali to be presented with it again. And perhaps at some appropriate time in this Olympics, you know, he lit the torch there, or the, what do you call that, lamp? What is it called? Well, the light, the flames. He lit the flames, which was a very touching moment. And perhaps somewhere in this Olympic period of time, despite the fact that tragedy struck last night, and I didn't know why I woke up at that hour and couldn't sleep and turned the TV on and watched through the night about the bombing incident there. Perhaps somewhere in this Olympics he will receive that medal, but it's still temporary. It still will fade. It still is not of the permanence that all victors want. Since all glory is fleeting, we must take the words of Paul and of Peter and of Christ as we conclude this sermon to recognize that if we want a non-perishable crown as part of our team effort, we are reminded in 2 Timothy as Paul is about to be killed, he says to young Timothy concerning his future. And you know that Paul was a team player. You know that he took a lot of hits and a lot of lumps and a lot of accusations. In verse 10, he talks of Demas, who loved this present world and had deserted him, had gone to Thessalonica, and others who had moved on, and how only Luke was with him in verse 11, and how he wanted Mark to come by with him, for he's useful for me in the service. And he wanted Timothy to bring the books and the parchments. In verse 8 he says, in the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness. See, that's not a temporary crown like a gold medal. That's a permanent one. And it goes to all team players. He says, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who love him and love his appearing. That's an encouraging note as we labor in this vineyard as part of the team. 1 Peter, the 5th chapter, and verse 4. 1 Peter 5 and verse 4. Peter also recognized, and Peter was one who should have recognized, because he wasn't always a team player. Not at all. He was out for himself. I go a-fishing because that's what I do best. Forget this team thing. But he came to learn and he came to know. And says, and when the chief shepherd appears, you will receive the unfading crown of glory. The non-perishable crown of glory. One that does not fade away. And finally, in Revelation, the 2nd chapter, among the promises given to the churches in Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus Christ, the greatest team player of all, promises in verse 10, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. This young team that I cite and other examples that you can extract from the world as it exists today and from history is full of individuals who recognize the importance of teamwork, of being on the team. What say you? Will we work together to strive as a team? For all of the students who have been with us this past week, I hope that you have extracted from your teachers here this notion of team and teamwork that you can carry back with you, because we will be here in Tyler or Lake Palestine doing what we can on the team. And every now and then we might have to take one or two for the team. But the reward of a glorious, non-perishable crown is our promise. It's your promise too. Let us win one for the team.